A People's History of Kansas City is brought to you with the support of Mid-Continent Public Library's Midwest Genealogy Center in Independence, Missouri, America's largest public genealogy library, supporting the research of both Kansas City's past and your family's history. Learn more at mymcpl/genealogy.
This is A People's History of Kansas City, a podcast from KCUR 89.3. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
I can remember growing up as a kid here, I could go to almost every block in the neighborhood and we had family members.
You know, you're like, man, why did I not know that before? This is my history.
People didn't come to Kansas City knowing that's where they were going to end up.
Latinos started moving to Kansas City in the mid-1800s, way back in the early years, while the city was still establishing itself. The main draw was railroad work. Now, this was the line of work that literally made Kansas City a major epicenter of moving goods throughout the country. And it still is. Kansas City is the second largest rail hub to Chicago. Despite Latinos' major contributions to literally building the early infrastructure that made Kansas City what it is, there are few local landmarks that credit their involvement or tell their story. On this episode, a history of Latino migration and integration into Kansas City, told through the story of one place called the Guadalupe Center, a place that is this history. I want to introduce you to my friend and colleague, Lisa Rodriguez, who dug into this for us. Hola, Lisa.
Hola, Suzanne.
So I know you, but other people might not. Tell us a little bit about who you are and why you wanted to tell this story.
Yeah, so I identify as Latina, and I grew up in the Kansas City area and kind of always knew about the Guadalupe Center. Now, I'm Chilean, not Mexican, but I feel like we went there when I was little for like parties or something. So it was something I vaguely knew about, but not the full story. So when I learned that it turned 100 years old last year, I thought it was crazy I didn't know more about it. You know, I actually learned that it's the oldest continuously operating Latino-serving organization in the country, and I feel like I wanted to know more about what's behind this place.
Yeah, that is an amazing fact. I didn't realize that it was that old. You know, as I mentioned in a previous People's History episode, I also identify as Latina. I have mixed Costa Rican and Ecuadorian heritage. And I've also always kind of known about this place growing up in Kansas City through family and friends and just everything that they do in the community. But I didn't realize how integral it was to Kansas City's whole Latino immigration story.
Right? Well, I'm going to start this story at, of all places, a gala.
Okay. Lisa, take it away.
Like I mentioned, Guadalupe Center celebrated its 100th year in 2019. And to celebrate, they threw one hell of a party. There was a live mariachi band, an auction, dancing, and great food. And I talked to tons of people who have never known a Kansas City without the Guadalupe Center.
I grew up right down the street from Guadalupe Center on Julio Cesar Chavez Boulevard.
I was born right across the street from Guadalupe School. That my parents are from the west side.
I grew up on this, just like her, a block away from the center. I learned to play ball, go swimming.
That was Eddie and Lucy Muskies and Michael Coronado, but I heard this over and over again from everyone, people who have been going to the Guadalupe Center since they were born, and people who have seen the center evolve over the last century. It started to help Mexican workers who just arrived in Kansas City and faced discrimination. I say Mexicans because those are the immigrants who first used the Guadalupe Center. Today, the center is about much more than Mexican culture. Sure, a lot of people who use the center identify as Mexican or Mexican-American, but a lot identify as Hispanic, Chicano, Latino, Latina, and even Latinx. And while the language we use to describe people with roots in Central and South America has evolved, the issues they face are still very much the same. At the gala, the president of the Guadalupe Center's, Chris Medina, took a moment to talk to me about how far the center had come from its early days a century ago.
You know, it's ironic. We're still doing some of that stuff. and here we are in, you know, 2019, and we're still talking about hate crimes and immigration and stuff. I thought we'd be beyond that. But
Chris Medina is a huge part of this story, and we'll get to that later in the episode. But what he says makes me think about how much the organization has actually changed. Although it was trying to address the same problems, the Guadalupe Center of 1919 didn't initially celebrate Mexican and Latino culture. The original Guadalupe Center was built to replace that culture. It's a story that involves war, the Catholic Church, even Tom Pendergast. At the turn of the 20th century, there were a couple different reasons Mexicans were moving to Kansas City. First was the Mexican Revolution. The country was really in upheaval. Secondly, there was a huge population boom in parts of Mexico, particularly in the state of Michoacán. So all these young, newly married men couldn't find land to start farms. A lot of them hopped on the brand new Mexican National Railroad to the U.S. border. And around that same time, World War I was starting, so American men were leaving to join war efforts, which means there were a bunch of open jobs, particularly on the railroads, and Kansas City was a major hub for that. Railroad companies from Kansas City even sent people to the border to recruit young Mexicans to come work here. Historian Valerie Mendoza says these men were happy to get a job no matter where it was.
If you're looking for a job coming from Mexico, right, this is like, you know, of course, yes, I need a job. I'll go wherever you sent me. People didn't come to Kansas City knowing that's where they were going to end up, right? It was just where the work was needed.
Mendoza works with Humanities Kansas. She lives in Topeka now, so we meet in the middle in a coffee shop in Lawrence. Mendoza is particularly interested in how migration to Kansas City was different from other places closer to the border.
If you migrate to Texas, it's easy to get across the border, right? Especially during that period. You hear people speaking Spanish. You could find the foods that, you know, you were familiar with.
Mendoza says fitting in places along the border was easy.
When you come to Kansas City, and that is not the case, you are one of the few, right? You stand out amongst the other people, even other immigrants.
So Kansas City sees this surge in Mexican immigration, mostly young men. And the group starts to look like kind of a bachelor community. After work, they're hitting up the bars and the pool halls and the boarding houses. Work on the railroad was tough. Some of the workers actually lived in boxcars. So it's natural they'd want to blow off some steam at the end of the day.
You know, this is the time of Tom Pendergast, too, right? Late 19-teens, early 1920s. So, you know, he was very much involved in those, you know, those bars and pool halls that catered to Mexicans. And so they get this reputation, right, of being lawless, most of it not deserved.
So you've got all these young men going back and forth from Mexico to Kansas City for seasonal work, living it up after long, tough hours on the railroad. And people were beginning to worry about the so-called Mexican problem. As part of the solution, the railroads encouraged the men to bring their families over, hoping it would bring some stability. And this is where the Guadalupe Center comes in. The idea was to Americanize these families. The Agnes Ward Amberg Club, a Catholic women's club made up of mostly rich, single Anglo women, starts a community center with a summer school for kids. And they call it the Guadalupe Center, after the patron saint of Mexico, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Also, that was the name of the church next door.
So it brought with it instant credibility. It brought with it even part of the culture of Mexico, right? Even though it wasn't run by Mexicans and that wasn't its purpose, just the name itself spoke volumes.
One of the leaders of the women's club, who to this day is known as the godmother of the Guadalupe Center, was Dorothy Gallagher. We don't have a lot of documentation of Gallagher's life outside the Guadalupe Center, but we know she came from a wealthy family in Kansas City and took a particular interest in this new Mexican community. A lot of the work the Guadalupe Center did in those early years focused on assimilating these new Mexican immigrants. Mendoza says the summer programs for kids were super popular, and it was easier to teach kids English and American customs.
And the thought was, oh, if we target women and children, then that will increase the Americanization among Mexican families. Children, because they're young and pliable, right? They learn things quickly. Mothers, because they have the authority over the home and the children.
The kids' programs were a success, but the sewing and cooking classes for the moms, they were a bit of a bust. The Mexican women were already excellent seamstresses and cooks. For these American women to try and teach them was insulting.
Why are you teaching me something I already know? Well, these club women wanted to teach the Mexican women how to make American food and how to clean homes, you know, to American standards.
Cleanliness. That was something a lot of welfare groups got hung up on. There had been an influenza epidemic in 1918, and an economic recession after the war led to layoffs at the railroads. The women running the Guadalupe Center saw families with tattered clothes and run-down homes, and instead of seeing hard times, they thought they were just dirty. So instead of offering health care or daycare, they offered public showers and trash pickup. It didn't take long for Dorothy Gallagher to realize they were going about this the wrong way. In those first few years, she'd been visiting the homes of people in the neighborhood, and they told her they didn't just want to learn English or how to clean a house. They wanted a place to gather and celebrate. So the Guadalupe Center had its first Gran Fiesta in 1926. There was dancing and music. The Mexican women made tortillas and other traditional dishes. And it was really popular. Valerie Mendoza says in addition to bringing the community together, it brought outsiders in to see the vibrant culture of these new immigrants.
And it kind of took away some of that stigma and on the one hand. But on the other hand, it was also this culture that was seen as exotic that was on display, right? So it was kind of this double-edged sword.
Still, Mendoza says the fiesta started to give Mexican families more control.
It was like, oh wow, you know, we can do this. And so then the Guadalupe Center started hosting things like musical groups. They had folk dancing groups that they started that became very popular.
The center added more resources, a baby clinic, summer camps, a youth baseball team, and a student newspaper. And by 1935, the Guadalupe Center was so popular, it outgrew its facilities. The Agnes Ward Amberg Club didn't have the resources to handle an expansion, so Dorothy Gallagher used her own money to buy land for a new building. She drew up plans herself and hired an architect to design the building in a traditional Spanish mission style. If you drive along Avenida Cesar Chavez on the west side today, you'll spot it. It's the large tan stucco building with red roof tiles and curved facades. It's nestled near the bottom of a hill and faces the rest of the neighborhood's mix of modest and modern homes. Gallagher called the new building the living room of the neighborhood, and it truly became that. She actually lived there and apparently never took a paycheck. People gathered there for meetings and parties and weddings. Remember, the Guadalupe Center started as a place to Americanize new Mexican immigrants. But as these new immigrants began to speak up and find their voices in the community, the center evolved. So basically, the Latino families were beginning to Mexicanize the Guadalupe Center by using it for their own purposes. It kept some services, like English classes, but it also became a place to throw family events, make tortillas, gather, and socialize. And so it chugged along until World War II, when Gallagher, the driving force behind the center, left. Mexican families were finally getting some say in how things were run at the Guadalupe Center, and World War II happens, which sets into motion a series of events that transform the center once again over the next few decades. First, Dorothy Gallagher leaves to join the war efforts in Europe, along with many of the young Mexican-American men living in the West Side. By now, these are the sons of the families that moved here at the start of the 20th century. In Gallagher's place, the Catholic diocese takes over running the center, With the name Guadalupe after the Mexican patron saint, a lot of people already associated the center with the church, and many Mexican Americans were Catholic, so the diocese had instant credibility with the community. But when these men came back from the war, having fought alongside Black, Anglo, and Hispanic men and women, they felt restricted by the church. By this time, the West Side had gotten crowded and Mexican families were spreading out to the suburbs and other parts of the city, but they were still segregated. This is about when the civil rights movement was taking shape. And researcher Teresa Torres says that tension was felt in the West Side neighborhood, too.
I think that you could say that it was this kind of growing awareness and consciousness of their own ability to be leaders that began to change the thinking of the youth and to say we all need to deserve to be treated equal.
Torres is a former board member of the Guadalupe Center. She's also a professor of Latinx studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and has been working on a project to educate people about the history of the Guadalupe Center. Torres says by the time the men got back from the war and settled back into daily life, they were tired of someone from outside their community running the show. That sentiment simmered and grew for years. And eventually, this group of young people decided to take some action. They wanted the Guadalupe Center to go from being a charitable organization run by the church to a real nonprofit that offers all kinds of services to the community. It all came to a head in 1974. The center had gone through several executive directors in quick succession. Community members serving on the board of directors selected someone from the community, Alfred Guillen, to take over. But the diocese had its own pick and overruled the community's choice, saying Guillen didn't have the experience for the job.
And in a meeting with the bishop, there were three representatives from the board, and one was an ex officio, Sister Carmen. And she said, essentially, well, how do we get someone to get experience and training if they've never been given a chance?
Torres says that was the real issue. People felt the church was keeping Latino people in their places as second-class citizens.
And that was really the argument the community was making. It's like, you know, how do you get people that are from us and that understand our community and our needs if you don't help us? And you always keep us as a secondary, that you're the ones, the great beneficiaries, to help the poor Mexicans.
The answer from the diocese was straightforward. Our way or the highway. They told the community to vacate the building. And that's when the Guadalupe Center split from the church. It was a rough couple years after that. There were several rounds of short-term directors, but eventually they got someone in charge who'd grown up with the center, Tony Salazar. When Salazar took over in 1978, his experience immediately brought legitimacy to the organization. He says it was time to get more professional.
You know, when I came in, there were no audits, for instance. There were funding there that hadn't been used.
Salazar took 2 years to overhaul the Guadalupe Center, but he doesn't take credit for what it is today.
I mean, that's Chris Medina, who I hired at that point, and he really took that organization and took it to a much, much higher level.
Salazar gave an opportunity to a young accountant who grew up in the neighborhood and who had gotten bored of the business world. The Guadalupe Center we know today, a pillar of Kansas City that serves the needs of thousands of Latinos, may not be what it is had Chris Medina not been here. At this point, we've been through several different chapters of the Guadalupe Center's evolution. The early migration of Hispanics to Kansas City, the growing voice of Latinos in its services, and a hard-fought battle to reclaim control from the Catholic Church. This last chapter, from 1980 to today, we could safely call the Medina years. He's that important. Chris Medina's ties to the Guadalupe Center go back to its earliest days.
My mother's family came to Kansas City in 1919, and they settled on the West Side. My great-grandmother, who came with 11 kids.
On a trip back to Mexico to visit family, his mother met a star futbolista, Chino Medina, who played for Atlas Guadalajara.
My dad was a big soccer star in Mexico. My dad played 10 years professional soccer in Mexico. In fact, he's in their record books, but he was scoring champion, the Mexican scoring champion, two times.
A large poster of his father in his uniform hangs on a wall in Medina's office at the Guadalupe Center. Photos and souvenirs cover the bright yellow walls, telling the story of his early life in Kansas City and the last 40 years he's been at the helm of this organization. Chris Medina was born in Mexico City, but his mother missed Kansas City, so they moved back to be closer to family. And when I say family, I mean lots of family. The Medinas are like Kansas City Mexican royalty.
Our last family reunion, we did it over at the Armory, and it's been a number of years now, but we had 900, 1,000 people there. So,
wow.
Yeah. I can remember growing up as a kid here, I could go to almost every block in the neighborhood, and we had family members.
Starting in 1980, when Medina took over as executive director of the Guadalupe Center, the organization transformed. Anything the community needed, the center found a way to do it. They noticed Latino dropout rates at area high schools was high, so they started an alternative high school in 1990. The Guadalupe charter system now has an elementary, middle, and high school, and two preschools. They saw that people were having trouble getting loans, so they started a credit union. After a spike in teen pregnancies, they set up a program to educate and help teenagers and young mothers. The list goes on and on. Workforce training, wellness courses, senior bingo. The Guadalupe Center now operates 18 buildings with a staff of more than 300 people. But most important to Medina is creating an environment to foster leadership in young people.
If we're going to have our population be successful and provide for themselves, we need to give them the tools to be able to do that, where they can find decent jobs, paying a livable wage, where they can provide for themselves.
After all, that's how the Guadalupe Center became what it is today. It may have been started by a group of white women as a solution to a problem, but it evolved. And when the time was right, it was turned over. And after a prolonged fight with the diocese, it was reclaimed by the very people it was created to serve. Chris Medina still appreciates Dorothy Gallagher for letting go of the reins when she did.
But when she left, she goes, my work's done here. And I really appreciate that, because she said what she had done was empowered the people where they could lead themselves. And that was huge. So, hey, she got it. Too bad the diocese didn't.
Medina says there are new challenges every day. For one, his neighborhood is changing. New young populations are attracted to the West Side, and some of the Hispanic people who have lived there for generations are being priced out. The latest property reassessments from the county saw some home values spike up to 500%. As it always has, the Guadalupe Center is adapting. Medina says they're looking to develop a mortgage loan program to help buy some of the rental properties in the area and give people an affordable place to live. And they're helping seniors fix their home and find responsible buyers.
One area that we need to really develop that we have not done a real good job at is getting elected officials, people to run for public office. So there's a lot of challenges there.
Now, Medina is looking at the next generation of leaders to represent the Kansas City Latinx community in the coming decades. It's an uphill battle, but Hispanic people in Kansas City are used to uphill battles. The Guadalupe Center now provides services for Latinos from dozens of different countries spread across the metro. And like Medina said at that party, while the population the center serves may be different, a lot of their challenges, discrimination, assimilation, hate crimes, are the same as they were 100 years ago, which is why Medina says it's important to share the history of Latinos in Kansas City, because it's not new. And if no one else is stepping up to the plate to help this community thrive in the future, then the Guadalupe Center will, because that's just what the Guadalupe Center does.
KCUR newscaster and reporter Lisa Rodriguez. A People's History of Kansas City is a production from KCUR 89.3, made possible with the support of the Midwest Genealogy Center, which can help you learn about the history of Kansas City through a searchable version of the Kansas City Star, dating back to 1880. Learn more at mymcpl/genealogy. We'd love to hear from you. Did this episode make you think of something that we should explore as a topic in the future? Are there people like Chris Medina, Dorothy Gallagher, or Tony Salazar whose stories need to be told? I'm not on Twitter or anything, so you got to send it the old-fashioned way. You can give us a call, 816-235-8930. That's 816-235-8930.
8930, and you can leave a message there, or you can send us an email, peopleshistorykc@kcur.org. Our team is made up of Sylvia Maria Gross, Mike Russo, Ann Knickendorf, Salisa Kalakal. We also had help from CJ Janovi, Cody Newell, Krista Henthorn, and Tracy Bauer. Our theme music is by Primary Color, and we also had tracks this episode from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Take care, and thanks for listening.